This is Anthony Lowenstein. I'm interviewing Haifa Zengana in Sydney. First question I had for you, Haifa, was you've obviously spent a lot of your time in under Saddam's Iraq.
Yes.
And you obviously were a political prisoner in Saddam's Iraq. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what, for some of us obviously who can only read about what life was like in that time, what sort of experiences and how do you look back on that time in your life now?
Well, it was in the 70s,
and yep.
In the 70s, the economy was fantastic in Iraq. It's the oil boom and the construction was going on continuously. The change of Iraq was the development of Iraq in the fields of education, and also it just started the whole program, health-wise also. So people were fairly okay. Fairly, and I think the base of most things is economy. If you have good economy, people can be engaged more or less in the daily life and forget about other things. Still, the oppression was there, but it was much milder than what it became at later stages. I was a member of the Communist Party, and a Communist Party which was not pro-Soviet Union. So we were almost like a Cuba faction, and we were looking for different kinds, for freedom from political oppression. Mm-hmm. So economy was good, politically wasn't very good, and at the time also there was the negotiation between the mainstream Communist Party and the Ba'ath Party, which was the which led by al-Bekr, not Saddam then. He was Mr. Deputy for Saddam Hussein. So it was fairly stable, yet the killing was going on, also the shooting of opponent to the regime was going on in different way. But it was deteriorated really in the 80s. I was active politically as a young woman, and I was arrested.
I should
be considered the terrorist of today.
Many people would.
The overthrown of the regime. We were working on the overthrown, and we were doing it also as more or less the Cuba style, because we were forming our resistance down in the south of Iraq, in the area of the marshes, Arab marshes. And also we had our bases in Kurdistan. It used to be, we never called it Kurdistan there, but it was the north of Iraq. So we had our bases there, and we were moving, and I was arrested while carrying weapons and bombs and all this stuff.
So at this time, obviously, as you said, when Saddam came to power, was your view of him, were you concerned when he came to power? Was there a sense of, obviously no one could tell what was going to happen, but what was your general sense about him when he came to power?
Well, it was clear, I mean, because the Ba'ath Party itself, there was, I mean, the general impression, they arrived to power, or that's exactly the words I'm quoting the Prime Minister then, quote, "We arrived to power on an American train." So in Iraq, we knew there is the involvement of the CIA with that government or with that regime.
Which, of course, we never read about today.
He was proud of it then, when this statement, but it's very quickly been buried.
Because.
So it's no point of declaring your connection with the CIA, especially, I mean, the word an American and CIA is very dirty in our country. So that was buried quickly and almost considered a mistake. It was clear from the beginning, from day one, of Mr. Deputy or the president later, at later stages of Saddam Hussein, what kind of regime we're going to have. Whether it's regarding Iraqis themselves or regarding the relationship with the regional countries or the world in general.
So when you obviously were a political prisoner in Iraq.
I was.
And how many years were you imprisoned in Iraq?
No, it weren't years. I was in prison for 6 months.
Okay.
And I was kept to the first couple of weeks for interrogation in a place called Qasr al-Nihaya, and this is called the Palace of the End, they called it. It's a term by political prisoners, because that's the first stage of torture then. And many of my comrades then, immediately they moved from there. We were arrested, they moved from there after the initial torture, and they were executed. I was lucky, in a sense, despite the torture, despite the initial period staying in that place. The bodyguard of Saddam is a relative of mine, and this is going on in Iraq, you see, as we are, because in one family you find a communist, a Baathist, it's like perhaps anywhere else in the world, but strongly there, and you can find a brother not speaking to his brother because he's religious or something. The relative of mine, his name is Sabah Mirza, funny enough, he was killed later. Mm-hmm. And you can still see him in the old footages standing there protecting Saddam Hussein all the time. So he worked hard to get me out from
and
there.
And succeeded, obviously.
Succeeded, yeah. But I moved from that first place to the Abu Ghraib prison. This is the infamous place.
Of course.
And then I was moved from Abu Ghraib to another small prison, and that's for prostitutes. It's just further humiliation to tell you that if you are involved in this kind of action, you are nothing more than a prostitute.
Yeah. Knowing, therefore, obviously your views on Saddam Hussein, I'm obviously interested to ask you what you think, therefore, of the trial, the so-called trial of Saddam now. I can presume that you do not regard as a legitimate trial. I wanted to ask what you think of the trial that's existing in Iraq at the moment for him.
We are under occupation, and this is the occupation trial. They're doing it because it suits their own timetable, it suits their own at-home agenda. They want to show the people also that we are trying to do something right. It's not going right in the right way. First, because they can easily dispute whether they are the accused in the trial, or people outside this building, which is held under the green zone, under the American and the British control, totally in that green zone. People can easily argue, well, look around you in Iraq now, in the streets of Iraq, and you see perhaps as many dead as what they killed under Saddam. This is the simplest of arguments. The other thing which is I feel strongly about is, yes, justice has to be done, but has to be done by Iraqis, because they were the victims. And we haven't seen this yet. Also, the responsibility, the moral responsibility of what's going on, and international law also, we have other criminals, and we see criminals are the invaders. And before the invasion, we have the criminals, people who imposed the sanctions for 13 years on Iraqi people. Sanctions destroyed the country, not just Saddam, not the invasion alone coming after that, but the people were exhausted. 500,000 kids were killed, literally, because of the sanctions. And we remember very well what Madeleine Albright said, it's the price.
The price
was
worth
asked,
it.
It's worth it.
Yeah.
So the woman even doesn't shy about or denying the fact that there are 500,000 children were killed. So this is the crime of the century. And we would like, I would like anyway, and many Iraqis I know of, they would like to see the same cage we are witnessing today, where Saddam and a group of people with him. We would like to see the Bush family, Tony Blair, the John Howard of today, of the people who were involved in this whole. Look, it's as simple as that. If you walk in the street and you have an accident, car accident, the driver will be taken to court for damaging your car, perhaps. For not killing you, even perhaps causing you kind of any damage physically, and somehow they might put you on trial, or they might imprison you, or you have a fine to pay. So in that sense, how are we going to deal with those people who are responsible? The Bush, the Blair, the President, other what they call coalition of the willing, those are the people responsible about crimes, one after the other, after the other.
When you talk in relation to the sanctions, it's something that I've written about quite a lot, and there seems to be a sense, certainly in the West and media, with exceptions, of real amnesia about what happened, how long it happened, the effect of what happened. And as I'm sure you're well aware, often the justification that was given by some leaders, including our John Howard in 2003, was explaining that one of the reasons he said Australia was getting involved was because Saddam was breaching the sanctions and therefore we had no choice. Now the fact that that was dishonest, and I'm sure you've read recently that the Australian Wheat Board in Australia was paying $300 million in bribes to the Saddam regime, which is just coming out in the last 6 to 12 months. How do you explain the fact that there is this seeming amnesia about the sanctions? Forget about the war for a second. Before the war. Some people know about it. But in the last years, there seems little or no discussion about what actually happened then, and in the media particularly. How do you explain that?
I think the media is it's almost a daily consuming or presenting of news, and yesterday or an hour ago is not a news anymore. They're doing that. They should be also held, I don't know how many people we are responsible, but this is moral issue. It depends on who are you in the media. We hear voices going on about the same thing. I mean, we have in Britain, Robert Fisk, for example. He tries his best to remind people of what's happening, because it is the continuity of events you're talking about. It's not you about talking about ancient history. You're talking about yesterday. And for us, it is yesterday, because we're still carrying on the consequences of the sanctions, and how severe, how harsh, how damaging it was, and it still is, because Iraqis, I mean, you look at the children in Iraq, really. I was amazed when I went, and I was trying to guess the age of children, and any age I tried to guess was wrong, because we have the stunt growth of girls, for example. Because of the sanctions. Clearly, it's by UNICEF reports, is we have stunt growth for the under the. And how can you ignore a crime like this? The media, well, they have to be more responsible. I don't know. I don't know whether you cannot deal with all these problems all the same, and you have answer for that. But they have to deal with it if they are trying to voice the truth or try to walk, to look into the truth. Not, it's not their job probably, but it is their job to highlight issues or asking people to look into various aspects of the issues. Or what we hear now is a repetitive of what the politician is saying. That's not the job of the media. I can't understand it that way. I don't know how far it goes, but this is my understanding anyway.
Since the invasion in 2003, you've written extensively about the effect on your average Iraqi people, but especially Iraqi women. And I wanted to ask you a little bit, before we get on to talking about what's happened since the war, why you were so against the war in the first place. Why, and I presume that many of your predictions about what would go wrong has gone wrong, if not, I suspect, worse than what you expected. Just to say a little bit about why you were fearful of a US-led invasion.
Well, it's I was one of many. I wasn't unique, really, because there were millions of people opposed the war, and that's, I was also one of many of working with international organization, humanitarian, and they were warning forcibly about the consequences of a war, because they've been working in a conflict zone, they know exactly what's going to happen from their own experience. My own feeling, personal feeling, was the fear for Iraqis and fear for the country and fear of what's going to happen later, because Iraqis were exhausted. I know them. They are my family. They are people I've I'm one of them.
As many of your families still living in Iraq,
I'm
guessing?
Yeah, more or less half of my family is still there, and because we are extended family, that means we're talking about something 40, 50 people. They were exhausted. They were under no way they could tolerate another hit. Another bombardment, because they were subjected to the bombardment. Another, 1998 until 2003, continuously. We had it twice weekly, the bombardment of the cities, no-fly zone, and all this arrangement. People were killed there. So the exhaustion was there, and we heard later, I think it was Paul Wolfowitz saying that when he was asked, why did you choose Iraq? And he said it was a doable job. It was. I mean, Iraqis were exhausted. Knock them and they can really fall. So with the malnutrition, with the shortage of everything, with the bad health, they could crumble. In a human sense, we're talking about. And yes, it's happening now. It's the same thing.
Have you been to Iraq since the invasion?
Yes, I went back the first time in 29 years, in January 2004.
When it was, inverted commas, relatively safe compared to what it's like now anyway.
Yes, definitely, yeah. Still, it was dangerous. Many areas, even in Baghdad itself, where there were... a few places you wouldn't dare go in, but I went there. I went to see. And
your sense then was what? I mean, obviously you hadn't been for many years, so there were many conflicting emotions inevitably when you would go back there.
Yes, it was a different Iraq altogether. It was different. Not I'm talking about human beings, not people. But I'm talking about because I left in the 70s, so. All the construction and building, if we're talking about the building and the place as changing features, obviously it was different. But also what is heartbreaking was looking at all the what it used to be, beautiful buildings and the streets, and you see the damage, the destruction. You could still see the building burned totally. It's almost skeleton of a city. You're walking through that. And what also is, I cried twice. The first when I see the museum of Baghdad, and
where it was obviously looted.
It
months
was
before.
Looted totally, and also the National Library, it was burned. So the valuable manuscripts, all the things that goes back, copies of books, goes back hundreds of years, if not thousands.
What I suppose interests me about that, it's extraordinary that when one reads about that sort of thing, and you read, of course, that the U.S. troops did protect the old building and they did protect the other buildings. Do you think there's a sense when the Americans went in there, and obviously the Britons and the Australians in a very small way, that there was a deliberate, they simply didn't care that the library, for example, would burn, or simply incompetence? Some would say it makes no difference. But I'm interested in what you think. Do you think it's a sense of they were